From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in the homes of millions of Americans struggling with poverty. What do they think when they hear about tax cuts and the Dow Jones Industrial Average? How do we address the inequality that has grown wider and more entrenched in this country? The presidential campaign hasn't exactly been about the issues. It's been about a president who interrupts at a debate and tests positive for COVID and declares himself immune. It's been about a country that is exhausted from the pandemic and from politics, but rarely has it been about actual ideas. Well, here's one, or here's three, really. The Biden-Harris campaign has a set of proposals that, according to Dylan Matthews of Vox, could cut poverty in half. In half. That sounds wildly optimistic at first glance. So this hour, let's dig into the proposals. Matthews writes, quote, "A new study finds that the Democratic ticket has put forward or endorsed a set of proposals that, taken together, could add up to the biggest anti-poverty plan in decades. Three specific measures, Biden's plan to make Section 8 housing vouchers universal, Congressional Democrats' plan for a $3,000 a year child allowance, and Harris's LIFT Act proposing new tax credits for low-income households, would have lowered the poverty rate from 12.7% to 6.5% if they had been adopted in 2018. That's according to researchers at the Center on Poverty and Social Policy at Columbia. That's 20.2 million fewer people living in poverty. The reduction in child poverty would be larger still, from 13.7% to 3.6%. Only about a quarter as many children would remain in poverty after the policy package's adoption." End quote. Is it really that simple? This hour, we discuss the viability of these kinds of proposals. Our guests include Pete Nabosny, Policy Director at the Children's Agenda. Pete, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Jessica Fleming is a single mother of two. And Jessica, I really appreciate you taking the time to share your story. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Kent Gardner is the Chief Economist at the Center for Governmental Research. Kent, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Howdy, Kevin. Evan, nice to see you.
Well, I'm going to...
Not to see you.
Well, you know, we can't quite see you for a little while. Nice to talk to you, Kent.
Right.
There you go.
Yeah.
Let me just briefly ask Pete and Kent to sort of weigh in on the broad strokes on policy. Then we're going to kind of get into more of the details. But I think it's important to hear Jessica's story, which is one of millions in the country. But I think it's important to put it in real human terms, not just numbers and statistics. Pete, I'll start with you. When we hear this kind of headline, the headline reads, "Biden and Harris's proposals could cut poverty in half." Do you roll your eyes or do you think, no, realistically, we're not far away. That could happen.
Well, I mean, I read through the analysis that Columbia put together. And I mean, I think as a matter of math, it works. It makes sense. You know, I think a lot of times our conversations about poverty, they get sort of overly complicated in certain ways where, you know, poverty is strictly defined, you know, measured is whether or not someone has, you know, sufficient income to cross a particular threshold. So if you have approaches like a universal housing choice voucher program, a kind of supersized EITC or income tax credit, and then a big expansion of the child tax credit, I mean, those things are getting resources into low-income families, you know, pockets, and that, you know, as a matter of math, again, it gets people out of poverty. And so these are targeted investments and targeted to particularly low earners. And so it would, you know, stand to reason that they would lift a substantial number of people out of poverty.
Kent Gardner, how do you see that?
Well, I like the way Pete puts that. I mean, it is at one level simply arithmetic. The politics are much more challenging, and I think that the other question, which really does get very complex, is how one pays for it, and you know that gets us into a lot of interesting conversations we've had this year under COVID about how much what size of a deficit the federal government can actually run affordably, how much debt we can assume as a nation, how much debt we should assume as a nation, and you know, rolling back to the last set of tax cuts that were passed in 2017, you know, what level of taxation is appropriate? You know, we have two very different ideologies, you know, about what tax rates ought to be and what will really lead to economic prosperity. So there's an awful lot to talk about, but I think that as Pete suggests, the clear pieces here, I think, I think, appropriate at some level. How they get designed is something else. One other point I want to make, though, is that a lot of our programs that, we call our safety net programs are currently set up to be wildly unfair. So even if we don't increase significantly with the amount of money that goes into the safety net programs, which, again, I think we should, we should certainly pay some attention to the inequality within those programs. I think of two in particular. One is, the Medicaid expansion that still has not happened in a dozen states, a dozen big states. So that's wildly unfair. And then second, obviously, the Section 8 housing problem is a huge, huge debacle, I think, and needs to be reformed.
Yep, Section 8 is part of this, and we're going to get into that in just a moment here. But let me ask Jessica Fleming for, I think, the lens of the people who might stand to need these kinds of programs. And Jessica, as a single mother of two, you got two in fourth grade. Give our listeners sort of a view of what life has been like for you, especially in this pandemic.
Well, so since the pandemic, my children are Rochester City School District students, and the gaps in that they are, even though they're fourth graders, they have special needs. They're both in autism classrooms, so they cannot go to our center. We are in a situation where, as a single mom, I have to take FMLA at my job in order to support them with remote learning. Which, I don't work for a company with over 500 employees. So I'm now looking at getting 2/3 of my income for the time that I'm using FMLA. So, like a lot of Americans, I'm living paycheck to paycheck as a single mom. I'm in a situation this school year where we didn't have, expenses to cut, there's not a lot of wiggle room. So I'm just kind of living beyond my means right now. And the first thought I have about this expansion of Section 8 is a couple years ago when I lost my job for a 6-calendar absence when my son was sick, which was not did not qualify me for unemployment. I was not able to get Section 8, not just because of a wait list, but because I had a landlord who wasn't accepting it. So, if you go down to the Section 8 office, the safety net office, you're going to find that one of the first questions they ask you is if you have any family members who can help you. So they're actually asking people if they have generational wealth when people go down to try to get safety nets to survive. We can expand Section 8 all we want and help these landlords profit off of poverty, but that's not going to change the fact that a lot of landlords won't take it, and that, the low valued homes. I luckily do come from a family where I was able to get some help from my mom holding, a lien on my house, helping me buy a house. But in the city of Rochester, these houses are getting bought for cash for far more than they're valued because landlords can profit off of renters, whether they be Section 8 or just people who can't purchase their own home at far greater than the value of the property. So to me, it's looking at some of these safety nets, it seems like they help keep people in poverty. We're not helping people own homes and kind of establish some generational wealth. Instead, we're helping keep landlords rich with some of these programs.
Well, and so do you think that the political leaders who are designing various programs, do you think that they have a sense for the reality of what life is like for you and for single parents?
No, I don't think, and I don't think that, it's not that we don't know that there are people who fall between the gaps. It's that we're looking to, win votes, and obviously, and then also to support enough people to get people on board. But there definitely is a simpler way. If we look at other countries all over the world, and I think that if it was really about helping people get out of poverty, we would simplify it.
Okay. Well, let me ask, Pete, can you weigh in on some of the challenges that a single parent like Jessica is facing and, sort of how that lines up with the kind of work that the Children's Agenda is doing to try to understand how to help kids in need and families in this spot?
Yeah, sure. So first thing, just to respond to on the issue of landlords, excuse me, not accepting Section 8. New York State did actually pass a law last year. It went into effect last spring, prohibiting discrimination based on source of income. That includes, you know, people who are getting assistance from DSS, people who receive public Section 8 vouchers. However, I was looking around on Craigslist yesterday, and there are still plenty of listings all over our community that say, you know, no Section 8, no DSS, things like that. So there seems to be some issues with adherence to the law and probably enforcement as well, if it's that transparent. But that is a huge issue in terms of people being able to access housing throughout the community. If there is that discrimination based on how you're paying for it, that really complicates efforts to, to reduce the concentration of poverty, to help people find the living arrangement that's best for them. And it's something that we really should be trying to tackle. I think the other point Jessica made, conversations I've had with folks on these issues, the administration of our public assistance programs is incredibly complicated. It is meant to, in many ways, keep people off of assistance. And I think that's a real challenge that people who are trying to navigate these systems have to face. And it ends up causing a number of people to not receive the help that they need. It's a real failing of our system. I will say, in terms of these three programs, particularly the LIFT Act and the Child Tax Credit expansion, those are designed to be simpler. You do need to file your taxes in order to benefit from those programs, but the very idea of them is that you're getting assistance through the tax system, which isn't always the best way to do it, but it does have the effect of this is cash that you're getting, as opposed to lots of benefits that are structured in lots of different ways with lots of different phase outs and all sorts of challenges in terms of navigating the bureaucracy. So there's certainly still challenges associated with receiving Section 8 assistance, but making a universal program like food stamps, like Medicaid, everyone who's eligible for those programs is able to receive it so far as they meet the criteria. That would be an enormous step forward, because currently nationally it's about 23% of people who are eligible for Section 8 are receiving it because of the limited funding for the program.
Yeah, I want to just underscore the point that Pete's making there, and I'll quote Dylan Matthews in Vox here. You know, Pete's talking about who's eligible versus who can receive a certain benefit. Food stamps, Medicaid do go to everyone who's eligible, and that's essentially what the Biden-Harris plan is for Section 8 for all. The idea that right now it's available, it's not all that available, as you heard, whether it's Jessica's story or so many others, and as Dylan Matthews writes, the following, quote, housing vouchers are a discretionary, not entitlement program. While food stamps and Medicaid go to everyone who's eligible, housing vouchers are administered by local housing authorities that receive money from the federal government. When they run out of money, those housing authorities stop adding new beneficiaries and set up wait lists that generally last years. Demand is so high that most authorities have closed their wait lists and aren't even adding newly needy households, end quote. So Kent Gardner, does it make sense to expand Section 8 for all?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, flatly, I think we should. The question again gets to be of affordability. I guess
affordability for the federal government. You mean, where does the money come from?
Well, yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, affordability for the federal government. Thanks for the clarification. I think that, and then there's an administrative challenge. I mean, the reason these are administered city by city is because the market for housing varies from city by city. So it's a very complicated program, and it needs a very complicated reform. I don't think, but certainly opening up the vouchers significantly, we could do that over time. We could create, budgetary line item that would increase by a certain amount each year. We could slowly improve access to housing, but it is a very complicated program. It's also, the administration of the program has been, I think, difficult really from the beginning. A lot of housing authorities seem to run into trouble of various kinds. I am not an expert on this, but when I see the kind of inequity, you know, particularly as, you know, as Pete points out, the percentage who actually get access to this voucher who are eligible, it's really shameful.
So, Jessica, before we move on to the other two prongs in this plan, you want to offer your final assessment for this idea of Section 8 for all? Does it make sense to you?
I mean, it's definitely an improvement on only 23% of people who should be eligible receiving services. But I still feel like, you know, the American dream wasn't getting housing housing that's all unaffordable provided directly to a landlord. The American dream is owning our own home and establishing some generational wealth. So I would still much prefer to see, you know, some progressive mindset moving forward when we think about poverty and we think about, you know, communities in poverty. If we can help communities purchase their own homes, and, you know, that helps on so many levels. It helps with community. It also helps with establishing wealth, which helps with the generational poverty. And we don't, you know, living in Rochester, it's very obvious that there are lots of people who are making a lot of money off of poverty by owning these houses and renting them for as much as they are.
Let's start with Kent. Go ahead, Kent.
I was just going to ask Jessica if, you know, if perhaps the voucher were to be something one could use for a mortgage, for example, would that address some of the concerns that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. And then just more, you know, investment in some of these, you know, land trust concepts. I don't remember what city it was in recently where, you know, we were able to win a lawsuit to win property because, you know, housing first, we know as a model is imperative for not just, you know, poverty, but all the other issues that come with poverty, right? With crime and addiction So just in general, I think that we, you know, like focusing on rent instead of establishing homes is, you know, not benefiting the community in the long run.
And Pete, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think it can't always, you know, it shouldn't be an either or. There's obviously huge advantages in terms of, as Jessica said, building intergenerational wealth through home ownership. And I think we need to do a better job at supporting, you know, first-time homebuyer programs, helping people build savings to afford a home, to be able to afford the upkeep of a home, which is, you know, an issue in places like Rochester with an aging housing stock. And we have programs that exist to help people with that, but they also need to be expanded. But there will be, you know, I think in any place, there's always going to be a percentage of people who are renting for lots of different reasons, including perhaps they're not sure how long they're going to live in that community. They may prefer to rent to not have certain responsibilities. And so, you know, I think we need to be thinking about both. The only other piece I'll make or point I'll make about that Jessica's raised a couple times, which I think is exactly accurate. There is this getting into the weeds a little bit, but we are talking about policy issues.
Absolutely.
Here, right? The way that Section 8 is calculated is based on the fair market rent of an entire region. And what that does is it sets a price that you're able to use that voucher for, what the landlord can charge. And because it's set for an entire region, it often allows landlords to charge more than the going rate in lower income areas, areas of more stressed housing. They can charge more in those neighborhoods for someone who's receiving Section 8 than they perhaps could for the, you know, someone who's not receiving it, someone who could be on that wait list. And so that is an example of where they are able to capture that difference and, you know, kind of make more money off of the program. There are proposals to address that, which would allow you to set a rent by like zip code is what I've seen. That would also have the effect of allowing someone to take that voucher and access a more affluent part of town, combined with those things we were talking about earlier, of prohibiting discrimination. And so the voucher would be greater in, you know, a more affluent area and that would decrease some of the housing segregation that we have in this community here, because the voucher may not be enough to cover an apartment in a wealthier part of our county, but it's greater than the cost of that apartment in a lower income part of the county. And so fine tuning the program, and Kent's kind of mentioned, you know, that there are challenges with it, but figuring out ways to fine tune the program to achieve some of these other goals is another really important, you know, step forward that we could take.
All right. So we're talking about the Biden-Harris campaign's three-pronged proposal that a number of members of the media analyzing this week, and at least one study indicating that it could cut poverty in half in this country if these three policies are enacted. Now, that's it's a lot more complicated than snapping your fingers and you've got these policies enacted and all of a sudden poverty cuts in half. But bottom line is the idea is out there that might be achievable. These are not impossible. Yes, as our guests point out, there has to be an a funding source, and Congress has to figure out a way to do that. But that's what we're talking about, how to address poverty in a meaningful and significant way. And one of the second prong, one of the three prongs, is known as the LIFT Act. I'm going to read now from Vox again. Quote, the LIFT Act proposed by Kamala Harris in 2018 as she prepared for her presidential run, and which became a centerpiece of that campaign as her signature middle-class tax cut, is essentially a massive expansion of the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit. The EITC is one of the largest anti-poverty programs in the U.S., and it offers cash to low-income people, particularly those with kids who work. And Vox goes on to point out that the LIFT Act would add another credit on top of the EITC, which would make the overall policy more generous to everyone, and especially to childless adults whose current maximum EITC is only $538 compared to nearly $6,000 for families with two kids, end quote. Kent, we've talked about the EITC over the years. Does this expansion offered up first in 2018 by Kamala Harris and now adopted by this campaign, does it make sense to you?
Some expansion of the EITC certainly makes some sense. I mean, there are a bunch of, you know, and the Vox piece actually talks about some of the competing ideas, but the essential components of this would be to increase the size. The other thing that's important about the EITC, again, it's an administrative issue. Right now, the EITC is limited to a lump sum payout at tax time. I think very few families in America, you know, budget so closely, so carefully that they can afford to rationally allocate this lump sum they get in one time a year. I mean, it really doesn't promote good planning, and it certainly isn't a good way to incentivize the behavior we're trying to do with the EITC, which is for people to get into the workforce. So the incentive value of the EITC, I think, is really largely gutted by the fact that it only shows up once a year. So let's turn the EITC into something that we see that families would see on a monthly basis, something that's predictable so that they can see the effect of their activity in the labor market.
Okay. Pete Nabosny, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Kent and I have talked about this a number of times. I mean, I agree fully on transitioning it to whether it's ideally monthly or quarterly if that's too much to manage.
As opposed monthly. To one lump sum, yeah.
As opposed to one lump sum, I think the it's also difficult because it's based on someone's prior year earnings, so your financial situation could have changed during that current year. So to have a better tie to kind of your current earnings and then subsequent, you know, needs, I think is another place to go. But I do think, in terms of the structure of the program, and this may sound a little funny coming from someone who works at the Children's Agenda with our focus, but the EITC is currently structured is extremely, focused on families with children, which I support. I think, you know, kids are really important and quite expensive, and we need to focus support there. But there is this inequity that exists. The childless adult EITC is wholly inadequate. It excludes people under 25 who are not dependents of others. So there are some real things we need to address in the overall Earned Income Tax Credit, and the LIFT Act, it does tackle some of those things. So I think that's a real improvement, while also continuing to provide you know, that material support to families with children.
Jessica Fleming, how do you see this one?
You know, I, like someone said earlier, I love the idea of a monthly credit instead of once a year. I think a lot of people who are living paycheck to paycheck don't even have the credit in order to be able to, you know, finance something if something happens. Like they have, you know, something breaks in the car, their washing machine breaks. If you don't have a line of credit, that's, you know, and you don't have the extra cash, it's really hard to wait until tax time. So monthly is definitely better. I think in general, all of these programs are better the simpler they are, right? So we know that poor people spend money, cash, in a similar way to any other middle-class person. We know that the ultra-rich, you know, don't spend it, right? But we all spend money when we have money. So I'm for any program that just is putting money, spendable money, in the hands of people who need money. I think that what we saw with the extra $600 for unemployment was a point to this, right? That people, you know, like when given the resources to be able to purchase their food, to be able to pay for their housing, to be able to buy clothes, to purchase the things that they need, that it relieves a lot of the stress to make it easier to do things like reenter a workforce or work on, you know, going to school or anything else, focusing on your family, anything else that needs to be done.
Pete Nabosny, did you coordinate with Jessica Fleming before this program?
No, we need to talk afterwards, though.
I mean, is that...
ideas.
That is just on the mark from what Pete Nabosny, among others, has been telling us for years, which is that when you can, simplify, especially when it comes to helping people who simply need cash to pay bills. You know, and I don't want to drift right back into UBI, but here we are again talking about simplification. Do these proposals, Pete, fall in the line of simpler or more complicated to you?
Well, they certainly, they're simpler. I mean, I think even just the basics of the LIFT Act, it's really hard to kind of, for someone to calculate on their own the what they're going to receive in the earned income tax credit, and that would continue with this proposal. But as a conceptual matter, as it's phasing in, as people are, you know, earning their first dollar, it matches what they're earning dollar for dollar. That's a pretty understandable thing. If I've earned $2,000, I receive $2,000. It's a lot simpler than kind of the current structure of the program. And then I think in these other areas, making Section 8 universally available is a great simplification because of what we were talking about earlier in terms of waiting lists and when they're accepting applications and when they're not. And I think the other piece that we haven't really spoken about, but is a real flaw with Section 8 now, is if your earnings surpass a certain level, you could lose that voucher. You cover 30% of your rent when you're receiving it, but only up to a point. So if you get a promotion or you're able to work more hours and you all of a sudden exceed the eligibility for that voucher, you lose it. And then if your earnings go back down, well, hey, they're not accepting applications right now. You have to go to the back of the line here. And so that creates an incentive against, increasing your earnings. And that would go away if there was the universal availability of it, because if your earnings went back down, well, hey, you can get this benefit again. So there are things like that that are simpler. These programs are still incredibly complicated, and we need to find more ways to simplify them. But having something universally available is a great simplification in its own right, and it helps people avoid having to make some really difficult choices about their job situation, their earnings, the kind of insurance policy that voucher would serve if their earnings dip. So those things, we have to take these things all together. And I think the third piece that we haven't spoken about, the child tax credit, that's probably the simplest of these programs in terms of understanding, particularly the proposal that the Biden campaign's put forward.
We're talking to Pete Nabosny from the Children's Agenda. Kent Gardner is here from the Center for Governmental Research, and Jessica Fleming, is a single mother of two in Rochester, and we're talking about these various proposals that have been put forward by the Biden-Harris campaign, a three-pronged approach to dealing with poverty, both during the crisis and beyond. And we're late for our only break. After our only break, we're going to get to prong number three, a child benefit of at least $250 per month for all but the wealthiest families. We'll talk about how that would work. And we'll get our guest perspective on that. We also have some emails and phone calls to work through from listeners as well. It's all coming up. Coming up in our second hour, the candidates for Monroe County Clerk join us for a conversation about why they want the job. The Democrat is Jamie Romeo, formerly a member of the New York State Assembly. The Republican is Carla Boyce, member of the Monroe County Legislature. They're talking about the work that they think the clerk's office needs to do for everyone. The candidates for county clerk on Connections next hour. All right, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Feels good to talk policy again. It's been a little while. The presidential campaign hasn't been all that heavy on policy, but we're talking policy this hour. And before I get to some of your feedback, let me just work through the third and final proposal that the Biden-Harris campaign has put forward regarding poverty. It's really not the final, but it's the one that's sort of viewed as the third prong here. And it's a child benefit. The leading child benefit plan in the Democratic Party, according to Vox, is called the American Family Act, and it comes from Senators Michael Bennet, Sherrod Brown, and Representatives Rosa DeLauro and Susan DelBene. The AFA and the version of it that Biden has endorsed to run through the duration of the crisis would dramatically expand the child tax credit, which currently offers up to $2,000 a year for family with significant earnings, but little or nothing for many poor people. And here's what Vox says, quote, the Biden proposal would expand the size of the child credit and make it fully available for all poor people, regardless of earnings. The benefits would be $3,000 per year or $250 per month per child ages 6 to 17, changing the current law, which excludes 17-year-olds, or $3,600 per year or $300 per month per child ages birth to 5. Kent Gardner, I'll start with you. How does that one hit you?
Well, you know, as Pete suggests, this is the most direct way. We're just, you know, putting money into people's pockets, closest to Andrew Yang we've gotten in these proposals. I think it comes down to a question of choices. I think are smack dab in the middle of asking how this gets funded, and you know, if we do move forward with this, what is it we're not going to do? Is it going to be purely funded by increases in taxes? If so, taxes on whom? What might be the ripple effects of those indexation? Or alternatively, is that going to be money we're going to spend instead of doing infrastructure investment, instead of doing more investment on R&D to combat climate change? As Pete says, this is pretty direct. You know, we're just moving money to people's pockets.
All right, Pete, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing I'll add is that the fact that the current structure of the child tax credit excludes people with very low earnings is really, I mean, it's just inexcusable. I think there's this idea with the tax credits that you want them all to sort of phase in so as an incentive towards work. That may make some sense in terms of the earning tax credit, although, as Kent mentioned, I think some of the more recent research on it suggests that the lump sum nature of it and the kind of confusing way it's calculated may blunt that effect. But a child tax credit is meant to help families afford the cost of having children, to help ensure that those children have their material needs met. And so to structure it in such a way that excludes people in deep poverty doesn't give that, you know, as their earnings increase, they don't get the full benefit until they get to a certain level of earnings. It doesn't make any sense if the goal is to help these children, help their families afford the cost of having kids. I'm really pleased to see, I think the conversation around the child tax credit is increasingly focusing on the fact that you don't need to have a phase in for every program. If your goal is to help children, low-income children, you know, get that support out to them. And then I think the other piece that I'd
I'd highlight here is the proposal has a slightly larger or $600 larger credit for young children, which I think is also sort of appropriately focused. You know, research shows that young children are the group that's most affected by the impact of poverty. They're the most likely age cohort to be in poverty in the United States. And so if you're going to, you know, as Ken's been mentioning, if you're going to make decisions about what you do with the resources that you have or could potentially have, I think it makes a lot of sense to have a larger benefit for families with children who aren't yet school age.
Jessica Fleming, how do you see this one?
Like other proposals, I mean, more is better. I do think, you know, when you're talking about a difference of $600 between kids who aren't school and in school and kids who are, you know, child care subsidies, and the way I understand it is a lot like Section 8. We, you know, lots of families that qualify for child care as far as their income bracket don't get child care because we run out of funds, right? So, and just like Section 8, actually even worse. So I have worked with other people in my field. I work in human services with people who've had to turn down a promotion because they will lose what it essentially turns out to be $500 a week in childcare over a dollar raise, right? So an extra $600 a year for kids who essentially need full-time care in order for someone to work, right, is really not a lot of money. I mean, yes, it's $3,600 is better than nothing. But, you know, I'm thinking about when, Senator Warren was still in the primary race and she focused a lot on child care subsidies and how as a country we need to think more about child care. If we really want to kind of level the playing field as far as income earnings and as well as families for, you know, single moms and single parents in general, we really need to invest in affordable child care beyond $3,000 a year. $3,000 will cover for one child, maybe child care for a few months, not even close to what it costs.
All right. So let me start working through some feedback from listeners, and I'll start on the phones. We'll get through some of your emails as well. Hello to Keith first on the phones. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, thanks for taking my call. One thing for sure, that if you give a poor person money, it doesn't go in their pocket. If it does, it's only temporary until they take it and spend it on something. So it does get filtered within the economy. But I think even before we actually consider doing something like that, we have to start at the beginning. And the beginning would be to have a national health care system in this country like the other industrialized nations. Because one thing it's going to do, it may be cost savings, not immediately, but eventually, because you'll be able to keep people healthy rather than try to cure them. And secondly, has there ever been an analysis if we had a single-payer health care where the government doesn't pay for it, the citizens pay for it via some sort of tax, whether it be a value-added tax or a sales tax, how much would it affect the Medicare cost that people incur by owning property? And how much would it affect businesses by eliminating the expense of health care? I think it would be monumental, and you take away the profit motive, because we don't have a health care system in this country. We have a health care industry, and there's a big difference.
All right, Keith, thank you very much. A lot there. I'll let Jessica jump in first. There's a lot he had to say regarding, you know, if you give people who are living in poverty money, it essentially starts to circulate pretty quickly and strikes them as pretty logical. But there's a lot there. Go ahead, Jessica. You can hit anything you want there.
Absolutely. I see, you know, from other people who work in my industry, who for the most part are all working poor, that they have ideas of where they're going to spend a stimulus or when we get our taxes back right away. And also, I'd like to speak to your point about universal health care. I think that it's not at all an accident that despite the fact that 60% of the country, not 60% of Democrats, 60% of the country believes that universal health care is the right move, that the Democrats left that off their platform. I think that has that says a lot about the health insurance company's check that may be headed towards the DNC. And I agree because, you know, like even like we said in the beginning of this program, the Medicare expansion hasn't been utilized in a lot of states, which is leaving a lot of working poor people unable to pay their medical bills. I personally am lucky that my children are disabled and that it's luck in that I can put them on Medicaid and I still pay an outrageous amount of money for my own personal health insurance, despite barely floating over the poverty line.
Pete Nabosny, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole other show on the merits of various healthcare proposals, and I think the price tag on the Medicare for All bill was $32 trillion over 10 years, which is a lot, but it also the various analyses of it also showed it be a lot of it would be, you know, it's shifting what people are already kind of paying through premiums and the employer-sponsored program into a single payer model. So that's a whole other can of worms, but it's certainly an interesting and worthwhile discussion. It's obviously gained a lot of attention over the last few years, and we have seen real improvements to Jessica's point around children's enrollment in health insurance. There are very few children in New York State who don't have health insurance now, which is a great improvement over the past. But there's still a lot of work to go. And to respond to Keith's first point, I mean, I think the research is pretty clear on the economic impact of some of these targeted, tax cuts or various programs for low-income people that, I mean, he's exactly right. Jessica's exactly right. Money comes in and then people have needs and they spend that money and it stimulates the economy. And it circulates, through the economy in a very different way than tax cuts for wealthier people do, because they are more likely to have savings, invest in other places, things like that. So there are very different spending patterns based on your income level.
Okay, Kent Gardner.
I think it's a great big bucket of worms. This not just a little can, but the I guess the point I made at the beginning of the hour is that one of the things we could fix, and I think we could fix fairly easily if the Dems take the Senate, would be fixing the problems with the Affordable Care Act. Affordable Care Act was kind of half of a reform. I think there was an assumption on the Obama administration that there'd be an administration that would follow them that would have the power to be able to plug some of the holes. You know, dealing with this issue of expanding Medicaid to all the states is enormously important. I mean, what people may not know is if your income is, $12,670, you live in Florida, North Carolina, Texas, there are a dozen states across the nation that didn't expand Medicaid. If you're right there at the federal poverty line as a single individual, you qualify for an Obamacare plan, 2% of your income, which is, $338. And yet if your income falls by $5 and you're below the poverty line, you're no longer eligible for Obamacare and you don't have access to Medicaid. So your insurance goes to absolutely zero, which is just stunning and incredibly unfair. So we can certainly do a lot. We can get towards a universal healthcare plan, I think, without going all the way to single payer. I think there's more support for that. You know, that preserves employer-based healthcare. There's a lot of nations that a lot of our peers in the world that accomplish that. The way they do that, though, is by somewhere near the cost parameters that they have is by having some fairly significant price controls on providers. So anyways, Pete says this is many programs, not just a 5-minute quick.
Well, here's an email from a listener named Tim on how to pay for this. He says it's tax increases. He says Biden calls for a tax increase on, but for no one who is making less than $400,000. Tim says that's a lie. Huge corporate tax increases are always passed on to the poor. All analysts of his plan agree that it will create higher unemployment. Explain how unemployment fights poverty for the unemployed. Kent Gardner, do you agree with Tim there?
I'm not sure I quite followed that. The tax increases on corporations are passed on to the poor.
That's what he says.
Well, that's going to be a lot to unpack. I mean, it's industry by industry by industry. If you increase taxes on Walmart, does that mean that Walmart's going to increase its prices? And because the people who shop at Walmart may be, middle to lower social class, does that mean that they're actually paying the tax? I don't. I'm sorry, Evan. It's just too much to unpack. Sector by sector, tax system is just really complicated. But I do think we're talking mostly about increases on income taxes. My pet peeve is what we've done to estate taxes. The estate tax usually used to actually drive some significant share of the total federal revenue, like 2.5% as recently as 2000. Now it's almost zero. We increased in the last tax act, we increased the threshold for the estate tax from $5.5 million, which was already pretty high, to $11.5 million, I think it is right now. So hardly any estates, it's 0.06% of all estates actually are subject to a federal estate tax. That's just ridiculous.
Okay, Pete Nabosny, what would you say to Tim, who's worried? He says all serious analysts say that Biden and Harris' plan are going to raise unemployment.
Well, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure if that's the case. I mean, I think, I'll defer to Kent on a lot of the economics of this. But I think we often ascribe too much responsibility to the economy, to whoever the kind of current administration is, and the policies they put in place. The economy is an incredibly complicated thing, involving a lot of different components. And as we've seen this year, certainly, there are external events and then our response to it that drive a lot of economic conditions. And so, I think we often give too much credit and too much blame to our government policymakers for the specifics of the economy in that moment. So whether unemployment is rising and falling is really, there's a lot of things in the macroeconomic cycle that could influence those things, rather than as simple as you've raised taxes by a couple percentage points on people making more than $400,000 a year, or you've raised the corporate tax rate by a few percentage points, and that's caused unemployment to do, X, Y, and Z. I think the economy is much more complicated than that. And we have, examples in American history of different tax structures and different economic outcomes, sometimes better and sometimes worse than we've seen now. So there's a lot there. And I think we do need to figure out how we're paying for programs at some level. And we need to structure our tax system in a fair an equitable way. And I think particularly the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit really do improve things in a good way like that. But we should think about the other end of the income spectrum as well.
Well, down to our last couple of minutes, and Jane in Rochester wanted to know about how homelessness would be handled. I would certainly not deign to speak for either a Trump or a Biden campaign about a plan for homelessness. But I want to give Jessica the last word here because, Jessica, when you talk about waiting lists for housing and availability of benefits, as long as there are the resources sort of locally to provide them, and there's a lot of people who can't get them, I'm sure homelessness is an outcome that ends up happening under the current system. I would give you the final thoughts as we talk about what actually helps people, what government is trying to do versus what works. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jane, for raising that question, because I think it's important. As a parent of Rochester City School District students, who I'm also pretty active. I'm an activist as well. One question that Rock Citizen raised last year around this time, when everybody was up in arms about us being $50 million over budget, is why are we not enraged that one out of every 10 students in the Rochester City School District is homeless? So, we, during an election, how it seems to me is that we are looking for voters. We are trying to appeal to progressives. And the homeless population, unfortunately, is also a population that does not vote. We see this when the media frames problems, we frame them in a middle class light. We even frame homelessness as a middle class problem a lot of times. It is a real concern. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's so important for us to really push the concept of home ownership, of housing ownership, instead of just vouchers to help pay for rent. I think that we have plenty of space for everyone that needs a home, right?
Well, and Jessica, I just want to say, as we run out of time here, I've greatly appreciated your perspective and certainly wish you well. And I hope we can talk again as we try to really understand how policy ends up in practice helping or hurting people. Thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Jessica Fleming, single mother of two in Rochester. Kent Gardner from the CGR. Thank you, Kent. Always good, sir.
Thank you, Evan.
Pete Nabosny, on apparently very short notice.
Yeah, thanks, Evan.
I could screw up a calendar with the best of them. Pete from the Children's Agenda. Thank you, Pete, as always.
Glad I could make it. Thank you.
Appreciate it. We've got much more Connections coming up next.